Well, good evening. It is a real privilege to be able to join you again this evening and to continue this conversation about the Bible in the lives of the founding fathers, what we can learn about not only the political experiment that they were engaged in, but I think we can gain some insights from Scripture itself by looking at how they read the Bible, what they saw in Scripture. And so we're going to continue that this evening. When Pastor Ryan first contacted me and we talked about the possibility of my coming out here, we talked about a few dates, and I think that in part we settled on this weekend because this is a weekend in which we celebrate President's Day. Now, let me just be very clear with you. President's Day is George Washington's day. And I think it's appropriate that we put the focus on the remarkable leadership of George Washington. And so I hadn't really planned it this way, but I'm going to want to spend the next few minutes together talking about George Washington's favorite Bible verse. George Washington's favorite Bible verse. And I think by looking at this verse that moved him so greatly, we can gain some insights on American conceptions of liberty in the American founding period. I think this verse that we will turn our attention to also gives us some insight into how the founding fathers viewed human flourishing. And I think that's something we would all desire to see, is the flourishing of our families, our communities, and our nation. And this verse that so appealed to George Washington was Micah chapter 4, verse 4. And we read in Scripture, "They shall sit, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it." Again, this is Washington's favorite verse. Like most men of his class and social standing, he was well acquainted with the eloquent prose of the King James Bible, and he often alluded to the Bible in his writings. But there's no biblical passage referenced more frequently in Washington's voluminous papers than this ancient Hebrew blessing and prophetic vision of a new Jerusalem. We read here the image of a man reposing under his own vine and fig tree, and it vividly captures the agrarian ideals of simplicity, contentment, domestic tranquility, and self-sufficiency. And in the few minutes that we have together, I don't want to so much as develop an argument, but I want to try to paint a picture for you. A picture that I think is being suggested to us from this passage of Scripture. And I think, in fact, what we will discover, that the picture that is painted here in Micah chapter 4 is really the picture of shalom that we read about in Scripture. This is a visualization of what it means when we say shalom. Now, a preliminary survey of Washington's papers reveal that he used this verse some 50 times during the last half of his life. And that's just the examples that have survived. Who knows how many other times he may have used this phrase, and we've lost records of that. Most, but not all, of the references he made to this verse were made in private letters, anticipating his retirement to Mount Vernon, his beloved home on the south bank of the Potomac River. And it should also be noted that Washington was not alone among his contemporaries in his attraction to this verse and the blessing that it communicates. The image of a man dwelling under a vine and fig tree appears three times in the Old Testament, in Micah chapter 4, in Zechariah chapter 3, and we also find it in 1 Kings chapter 4. There's also a reference to the vine and fig tree in the books that we sometimes call Apocrypha. And Washington would have also been familiar with that portion, those texts. And it's mentioned in the book of Maccabees as well. And again, Washington was almost certainly familiar with all of these mentions of the vine and fig tree as they appear in these various texts. But I think we can say with some certainty that the particular rendering of this metaphor of the vine and fig tree that attracted him was that which we find in the fourth chapter of the book of Micah. So a question that I want to put on the table this evening is, what was it about this particular verse that was so appealing to George Washington, as well as many of his contemporaries? And what does his frequent recurrence to this Hebrew blessing reveal about his own character, his values? Now, we all know that George Washington was a soldier and a statesman. However, his life as a farmer, a career of his own choosing, is what truly captured his imagination and gave him greater fulfillment and satisfaction than his life in the military or in politics. His plantation at Mount Vernon inspired his affection for the land and for agricultural pursuits. I think we can say Mount Vernon was George Washington's vine and fig tree. Although his public duties often necessitated long absences from Mount Vernon, it was never far from his memory and his imagination. And his many references to Micah 4:4 are laced with a nostalgia for Mount Vernon and a longing to return to happier, more tranquil times filled with the agricultural pursuits that brought him so much pleasure and satisfaction. And this is evident in a letter he writes in April of 1797. He says, "I am once more," this is, by the way, a letter he writes shortly after he's retired as the President of the United States. And he says, "I am once more seated under my own vine and fig tree and hope to spend the remainder of my days in peaceful retirement, making political pursuits yield to the more rational amusement of cultivating the earth," end quote. Now, Washington, in the course of his very public life, made two dramatic exits from the public stage. He served for about 9 years as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army and retired to Mount Vernon. Again, after a 9 years absence. He thought he was coming home to Mount Vernon for the remainder of his days, but we know history turned out differently. His fellow countrymen called him into service once again, and he served for 2 terms as President of the United States. And once again, he leaves Mount Vernon for 8 years. I emphasize that because I think we sometimes forget the sacrifice that a man like George Washington made. Imagine in your own mind the place you love most on this earth. Would you happily leave for 9 years, followed by another 8 years for a difficult and frustrating job like President of the United States? And yet he was willing to do that in the service of his country. And it's on both occasions, as he anticipates leaving military service, leaving the president, that his mind is all again and again drawn back to Mount Vernon. Now, the millennial vision of a new Jerusalem that we read about in Micah 4:4 distills with striking beauty and brevity the highest aspirations of humankind. Few passages in all of Scripture, indeed, I would say in all of literature, have so eloquently captured the human longing for peace, for contentment, for prosperity. So let's look at this verse in its context. And I want to read the first 4 verses of Micah chapter 4. And I'm going to be reading from the King James Bible because, again, this would have been the English language Bible that George Washington would have been familiar with and the one that he and his countrymen would have read. So follow along as I read, starting with verse 1. But in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come and say, Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. And how do we know that? We know that because the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it. This is the word of the Lord. Now the prophet Micah ministered at a time when the nation Israel constantly faced the threat of war and the reality of war. And in Micah chapter 4, we see a vision, a glorious vision of Jerusalem's future when God's plan for history has been fulfilled. This is the new Jerusalem. And what do we hear? What do we see? This is the last days when the peoples and nations of the world will be drawn to the mountain of the Lord, to Mount Zion, and they come to receive divine instruction. God will teach us of his ways, we read. We will walk in his paths. God's laws shall go forth, and there will be a turning away from all other gods. Then we get to that beautiful language that we find in verse 3. God will arbitrate disputes among the peoples and the nations of the world. Nations shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore in this new Jerusalem. This is a place where God's perfect justice will be dispensed. Enmity will be set aside. Fear will be banished. This is a picture of shalom, the way things were designed to be. This is a perfectly ordered and fully restored existence. It's a beautiful picture. I've never seen this, but I've been told that these words about beating swords into plowshares and pruning and spears into pruning hooks are actually engraved over one of the main entrances to the headquarters of the United Nations in New York. And you can understand why. But let me tell you, the peace that's being described here is not the product of human diplomacy. Rather, it is the work of the Prince of Peace. The horror of war will become a thing of the past when the Prince of Peace is enthroned in Mount Zion. It's not going to be the work of the United Nations in New York, I assure you. And then we move on to verse 4. In the New Jerusalem, governed by the Prince of Peace, every man shall sit in safety under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. And again, we know why we can be confident of this, because the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. Now, the security and the serenity and the prosperity of this future age are illustrated by the vine and the fig tree. This is, my friends, a picture of the last days. It's looking forward in time. But there is a kind of nostalgia in the words that we read here in chapter 4. It's such a beautiful picture that we could easily dismiss it as unrealistic. It's a utopian vision. It will never happen. But the prophet Micah does something very interesting here with language. In describing and visualizing this new Jerusalem, using the vine and fig tree, he recalls a time in Israel's past. It is the only time in Israel's history when they enjoyed an extended period of peace and prosperity. And we read about it in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 25. And there we read, Judah and Israel dwelt safely, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, from Dan even to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. Now notice what he's doing here. We could dismiss this picture of the New Jerusalem. That's not going to happen. That's unrealistic. But he tells us about a time in the past when Israel, in fact, enjoyed peace and prosperity. And so we can kind of grasp the possibility that this could really happen in the future because it's happened in the past. What we read about in 1 Kings. And so suddenly, the impossible seems possible because God had blessed Israel in the past and they had in fact for a moment enjoyed this peace and prosperity that's being described under the vine and fig tree. Now the vine and the fig tree are interesting symbols that we find in Scripture. They're rich with symbolic meaning. And we really could spend we could spend a whole sermon series just talking about the symbolic significance of the vine and fig tree as it appears in Scripture. These are items that are rich with meaning in both the Jewish as well as the Christian tradition. Vines, grapes, wine, figs all have multiple symbolic meanings. The representations of the vine and the fig tree are in many respects similar. Both the grape and the fig represent sustaining life, vitality, fertility. These are blessings. Together, when you see the vine and fig tree together, these are signs of national as well as individual security, peace, and prosperity. The cultivated vine and fig tree, which require years of patient labor before they bear fruit, also represent continuity and stability because it takes many years to be able to plant a fig tree and have it grow large enough that you can then begin to train a vine to grow up the stout trunk of a fig tree. So when you see them together, and you will see them in the imagery and the motifs of the Middle East, even today, these are symbols of an extended period, extended time of peace and prosperity. I should also add that in Scripture, when you see a barren fig tree or a barren vine, that is not a good thing. It's a symbol of curses. So again, we're talking here about symbols, vines and figs, that are rich in meaning. They were rich with meaning for the prophet Micah's audience. They are symbols deeply ingrained in the Jewish tradition. And they similarly resonated with George Washington, the Virginia planter, who loved the earth and its fruits. The vine and fig tree represented everything that attracted Washington to the land and drew him home to Mount Vernon. So once again, let's come back to this question. Why was this biblical passage so appealing to George Washington? So appealing that he comes back to it time and time again. Well, this prophetic text addresses themes that I believe are of vital and enduring importance to Washington. They were importance to Washington the citizen, Washington the farmer, Washington the warrior, and Washington the statesman. These ancient words embody a reassuring message of freedom from want, freedom from fear. And in the American experience, the vine and fig tree come to represent respect for civil and religious liberties. So let's look a little more closely at the great themes that we find in this metaphor of a vine and fig tree, this symbolism of the vine and fig tree, the very things that I believe appealed to Washington. And we start with freedom from want. Freedom from want. The motif of the vine and fig tree represents freedom from want. The image of a man sitting undisturbed in safety under his own vine and fig tree is a picture of contentment. Contentment is to be free from want. It is the opposite of greed, envy, covetousness. And the Bible, of course, instructs us over and over again to be content. In Hebrews chapter 13, we read, "Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have." Micah 4 reflects this agrarian ideal of a simple and modest existence, of neither desiring nor acquiring more than one's own produce, and of respecting the fruits of your neighbor's labor. In the Psalms, we read in Psalms 128, "When you eat the labor of your hands, you shall be happy, and it shall be well with you." I think this is in part what's being communicated through this metaphor. It implies being content with your own vines and figs without yearning for or coveting the vines and figs which others have produced. And let me tell you, this is a radical vision given what we know of human nature. It repudiates a culture and a lifestyle of materialism and consumerism. There can be no peace so long as people consume far beyond their means or covet a neighbor's belongings to satisfy one's own rapacious appetite. And so long as men and nations use swords and spears to take what rightfully belongs to others. Few fears threaten one's contentment and security more than the fear of homelessness. Shelter under the spacious leaves of one's own vine and fig tree promises freedom from the fear of homelessness. One's home provides not only shelter, but also a sense of belonging, refuge, solace, security, comfort. And again, Mount Vernon, Washington's vine and fig tree, provided a welcome retreat from the hustle and the bustle of his very public, very demanding and challenging life. And his papers attest that Washington regarded Mount Vernon as a retreat from the harsh realities of the world around him. The vine and fig tree can also be a metaphor for hospitality and good neighborliness. This is particularly evident in the rendering of the metaphor in Zechariah chapter 3, verse 10. And hospitality is a virtue encouraged in Scripture. Deuteronomy 10, verse 17 through 19. Romans 12, verse 13. Hebrews 13, verses 1 and 2. And we could go on. And hospitality was a virtue that was liberally practiced by George and Martha Washington. And Washington often used the phrase vine and fig tree to extend hospitality. Let me give you an example. He extended hospitality to Governor John Henry of Maryland, who lived on the other side of the Potomac River from Mount Vernon. Writing to him in April of 1798, and I quote, "If to relax and diversify the scene a little, you should find it convenient and agreeable to yourself to extend your walks to the Potomac, I should be very happy in seeing you under my vine and fig tree." He's inviting the governor to come and relax at his home. Washington's hospitality towards longtime friends and strangers alike was legendary. Because of his fame, and because of the location of Mount Vernon, which was on a main north-south highway, strangers and friends alike, uninvited guests, frequently stopped at Mount Vernon, where they enjoyed a meal and often stayed the evening. And Washington's hospitality did not falter despite the overwhelming crush of visitors. It's been estimated that in the 7 years between 1768 and 1775, roughly 2,000 people were entertained at Mount Vernon, many of whom stayed for days on end and visited repeatedly. In April of 1774, which I think is a rather typical month, an average of 4 to 5 guests joined the Washingtons every night they sat down for dinner. In the last 20 years of their married life, George and Martha only had 2 nights when they dined alone. That's hospitality, friends. That's hospitality. And I sometimes kid with my wife, imagine what our lives would be like if we extended hospitality in similar measure. But that's virtue. There's a virtue in that kind of hospitality. And then until the end of his days, neighbors and friends and strangers alike found hospitality under George Washington's vine and fig tree. Many commentators have seen in this passage at least an implicit recognition of the right and the blessing of peaceably owning, possessing private property. Notice, every man sitting under his own vine and under his own fig tree. And if I had more time, I would give you some examples of how this metaphor was used in defense of this idea of private property. In perhaps even broader terms, the vine and the fig tree represent the desire of individuals and close-knit families to live secure in their property and their domestic autonomy, a desire to be left alone, especially to be left alone by overly intrusive civil state. This represents a longing to be left alone in peace and security from things like ruinous taxes, excessive governmental regulation, religious persecution, and the like. And this resonated with many Americans in Washington's day, and I dare say it resonates with many Americans today. Secondly, this image of the vine and fig tree represents freedom from fear. Freedom from fear is a second component of this blessing. The vine and fig tree, as previously noted, are traditional Jewish symbols of peace and prosperity. And moreover, the blessing of Micah 4:4 continues with this comforting assurance, and none shall make them afraid. This is a promise that echoes the ancient blessing that we find in Leviticus 26:6. It describes a life free from the war and rumors of war, a life beyond the reach of anxiety or worry about tomorrow. This is liberation from terror today and from the threat of disturbance in the future. We read in conjunction with the preceding description of the New Jerusalem, in which nations shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nations shall not lift up sword against nation. The blessing, more specifically, entails freedom from the fear of war. And I have to think that this surely appealed to the old warrior General Washington, for few pray so earnestly for peace and safety as those who have known war. More generally, the vine and fig tree represent the security to produce and enjoy produce unmolested, either by lawlessness or by the usurpations of the state. Again, commentators through the ages have seen in this passage the necessity for the rule of law, the protection of one's own vine and fig tree from lawlessness, from the robbers and thieves that would break in at night. They also see a repudiation of statism or big government. A society unbounded by law and civil order threatens all vines and all fig trees with theft and with plunder. And the objective of a good government, Americans of Washington days often said, was to ensure that every citizen could dwell in safety under his own vine and fig tree. And a state system that claims and consumes and devours every fig from every personal fig tree, every grape from every personal vine, is a terror to the citizen sitting under his own vine and fig tree. A big government that taxes excessively, spends voraciously and irresponsibly, confiscates private property, stifles innovation through excessive regulation, infringes on personal liberties, threatens the security and contentment of life under one's own vine and fig tree. And this, too, is represented in this image. Thirdly, the vine and fig tree represents freedom of religion. Freedom of religion. Now, you can read the commentaries of Micah chapter 4 over many centuries, and they will speak to these great themes of freedom from fear and freedom from want. But this idea of the vine and fig tree as a metaphor for religious liberty seems to be an American innovation. We find very occasional connection between the vine and fig tree and religious liberty in earlier writings, but it really is an idea that Americans embrace, and they embrace it in the late 1780s and well into the 1790s and beyond. And I think there's a reason for that. And it has to do with the First Amendment to the Constitution that recognizes the right to the free exercise of religion. And so as we move from the late 1780s and the 1790s, this idea of freedom from religion is very much on the minds of Americans. And then we begin to see the literary uses of this metaphor to connect the vine and fig tree as a symbol of this enjoyment of religious liberty that we find here in America. And let me give you some examples of this particular use of the vine and fig tree. Let me start with a minister named Israel Evans. He was one of Dr. John Witherspoon's students. And in fact, he was James Madison's classmate at the College of New Jersey. And in a sermon he preaches in 1791, he says this, and I quote, "Oh, happy people who live in this land, in this age of religious liberty. Here in America, every man has equally the freedom of choosing his religion, and may sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and on account of religion, none shall make him afraid." Or here's an example from Thomas Baldwin. He was the minister at Boston's Second Baptist Church. Notice how he uses the vine and fig tree in a Thanksgiving Day sermon. And I quote, "We are a people highly favored of the Lord. Our civil and religious privileges are none of the least. We sit under our own vine and fig tree, and none are permitted to disturb or make us afraid. We worship God according to the dictates of our own consciences, without the dread of an inquisition or the fear of persecution." End quote. Praising the protection of natural rights under the National Constitution, a Connecticut clergyman linked the metaphor with religious liberty in a mid-1790s Thanksgiving Day sermon. And this is what he said, quote, "Here, all denominations of Christians are allowed to enjoy their principles and to worship God according to the views they entertain of His holy word. In an emphatical sense, we now sit under our own vine and fig trees." End quote. Here's another example. This comes from the New England Baptist Association. Now, the Baptists in New England had experienced firsthand what it meant to be denied full religious liberty. And notwithstanding the experience of Baptists in facing religious persecution there in New England, this is what the elders and messengers of a prominent Baptist association wrote in the mid-1790s. Quote, "It is our happy lot to live in an age when the churches of Christ sit under their own vine and fig tree, and none are suffered to make them afraid. Persecution for conscience' sake is almost universally discountenanced, and the instances in which any of our brethren suffer the spoiling of their goods are comparatively few. Our churches in general have rest and peace." End quote. I have one more example that I want to give to you. And I've left the best for last, I think. This takes us back to George Washington and a letter that he writes in 1790. A letter that's written shortly after he has assumed the presidency of the United States. And I'm just going to say here, I think this may be one of among the most important letters in American history. It's an important letter, and it's worthy of our time. It's a letter that Washington wrote to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island. And notice how he connects religious liberty with the vine and fig tree. Listen carefully. He says, "The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while every one shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid." Now, this text is notable for Washington's clear articulation of what I believe is Americans' greatest contribution to political society. This is the most important contribution Americans have made to political thought. And notice what he says. He says, here in America, all possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship, and it is now no more that toleration is spoken of. This innovation that he's speaking of, he says, in America, we've abandoned a policy of religious toleration, and we have embraced in its place religious liberty, the liberty of conscience. Now, why is this significant? What's the difference between religious toleration and religious liberty? This is the important point. Religious toleration is a policy that presumes that there's a human authority that in its benevolence is going to allow you to practice its religion. And if that human authority can give you the privilege of granting you the right to practice your religion, what can it also do? Take it away. Now, toleration was the best, the most liberal policy that Europe had to offer. But Americans came to this side of the Atlantic in pursuit of liberty, an idea that there's a natural right that's been given to us by God, and if God has given us the right to practice our religion, can the state take it away? No. Can any other human authority take it away? No. This is a profound innovation. We now no longer practice toleration. We've embraced liberty. We've embraced liberty of conscience as a natural, inalienable, fundamental right that's beyond the reach of the civil state. It's beyond the reach of the magistrate. It is, in fact, a gift from God. So let me conclude this evening with a few comments on constitutional and popular conceptions of liberty, in particular religious liberty, in late 18th century America. The definition of religious liberty was in a state of flux at this time in American history. So you're going to find that different Americans are defining it a little bit differently. But I think there's some core ideas as to what religious liberty meant to Americans at this time. States like Virginia had embarked on bold experiments in religious liberty, and they're going to express this in their Virginia Declaration of Rights that's adopted in June of 1776. It's also going to be enshrined in the rightly celebrated Virginia Statute for Establishing Religious Freedom, which was signed into law in Virginia in January of 1786. By the way, how many of you know that there's every year a national commemoration of Religious Freedom Day? It occurs on January 16th, because that is the day that the Virginia Statute for Establishing Religious Freedom was written into law in 1786. And we should celebrate these great expressions of religious liberty. These were state initiatives that would have a profound influence on other states and would come to shape how we as Americans think of liberty in our own evolving constitutional traditions. And this is how Virginia expressed its understanding of religious liberty at the end of the 18th century. Religious liberty affirms a right to believe and practice one's religion voluntarily according to the dictates of one's conscience, free from coercion, punishment, interference, or discrimination by the civil state. Every citizen is afforded liberty to make inquiries into religious matters, to profess religious beliefs, and to worship God in a time and manner of one's own choosing, without obligation to the civil state to make any religious profession or to attend any religious worship. Moreover, religious liberty ensures freedom to profess and support one's religious beliefs without diminishing one's civil rights and capacities. This is what religious liberty is coming to mean to Americans at this time in history. And let me just say with great lament, we live in a time and we live in an age when I fear we're losing sight of this understanding of religious liberty. In fact, I think we live in a time increasingly where we view it as something to be tolerated. The state will grant us or allow us to practice our religion so long as we practice in such a way that it doesn't offend the sensibilities of the public state. And I think that should concern us. That should excite our alarm. This is a battle that was fought 250 years ago. And here we are in the 21st centuries, and I fear, my friends, we are in a sense losing that battle. And we're going to increasingly see these challenges where the state is going to tolerate us until the point when they don't tolerate us. And so it's proper, as James Madison said, to take alarm at the first experiment on our liberties. So the vine and fig tree represented ideals that loomed large on the landscape of the new nation. In late 18th century political discourse, the vine and fig tree emerged as a rich, multifaceted metaphor for evolving American conceptions of liberty, both civil and religious. The very mention of the vine and fig tree has become a shorthand expression of talking about liberty for Americans at this time. In a previous session, I mentioned John Dickinson, an important founding father that has been sadly forgotten. But he speaks of this in a very interesting way, and I want to draw your attention to an essay he wrote in 1788. This was an essay he wrote designed to persuade Americans to adopt the Constitution. This is written in the midst of the ratification debate. And he writes that an individual's capacity of enjoying his rights to the best advantage, a repeal of his fears and tranquility of mind, is a perfect liberty. A perfect liberty, better described in the Holy Scriptures than anywhere else, in these words or these expressions: when every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid. Notice what he's doing here. He's using the vine and fig tree as a metaphor, a powerful metaphor for liberty. And not just liberty, what does he say? Perfect liberty. Perfect liberty. Liberty was a valuable political good and a great aspiration of the American political experiment. Essential to this notion of liberty is the freedom to pursue one's calling, to provide for one's basic needs and those of one's family, to peaceably enjoy and possess private property, to worship God according to the dictates of one's conscience, and to participate in the community's exercise of political self-determination and self-government, subject to the divine moral order and the rule of law. The late historian Pauline Mayer wrote a book just about 20 years ago, a book that won great critical acclaim, a book called The American Scripture, American Scripture. And in this book, she meditates on the meaning of the Declaration of Independence, memorable phrase, the pursuit of happiness. What does pursuit of happiness mean? It's a hard question, and historians have debated this for many, many decades. It's a phrase of uncertain origin and, of course, disputed interpretation. But interestingly, Pauline Mayer says the founders' understanding of this most important pursuit was informed by the Hebrew Scriptures. And this is what she writes. She says, "For Jefferson and his contemporaries, happiness, no doubt, demanded safety or security, which would have been in keeping with the biblical phrase one colonist after another used to describe the good life, the flourishing life, we might say, to be at peace under their vine and fig tree with none to make them afraid." This felicitous phrase, pursuit of happiness, encapsulates much that is essential and vital to the American identity and character, a desire for sufficient security to produce and enjoy the fruits of one's labors, unmolested either by lawlessness or by the usurpations of the state. It is the right to possess property, a longing to be left alone, the right to worship God according to the dictates of one's conscience. Life under the vine and fig tree is a picture. I've said this before, it's a picture of shalom. the way God designed and intended things to be. It's a perfectly ordered, perfectly restored existence. It's a world of perfect liberty. And I hope when you encounter this metaphor, as you surely will, that you remember this picture that is painted in these simple words, life under the vine and fig tree. Thank you very much for your attention.